The Earth is about 4.5 billion years old, and it's probably going to last for at least another 5 billion years or so. So we're actually standing or sitting at a midpoint in geological time. And it's a very vast time scale. In fact, 5 billion years is kind of mind-boggling when recorded history only covers a few thousand years. So to kind of illustrate this disparity of scale, let's imagine that geological time is represented on a 24-hour clock, with the present time being high noon. So on this clock, each second represents 100,000 years. Let's see what's happened. The time is 4 a.m. Not much has happened during the first 4 hours except for surface cooling and rock formation. Between 4 and 5, the first microscopic life appears on the Earth, and an oxygen atmosphere develops. About 11 o'clock, the first planets appear, and by 11:15, there are both fish and ferns. About 11:30, reptiles appear on the scene, and by 11:40, great dinosaurs rule the world. About 8 minutes before noon, the first mammals appear, and 2 seconds before noon, primitive human beings enter the picture. Recorded history began about 5/100ths of a second ago. The Declaration of Independence is signed 2 milliseconds before noon. Well, what's going to happen during the next 12 hours until midnight? Human beings who have lived here only for about 2 seconds will probably be around for several hours yet, we hope. What about the natural resources on which life depends? What about the minerals, the fossil fuels, the oxygen, the water, and so on that we need for survival? During the past century, man has probably changed the surface of the Earth as much as it changed during the previous 100,000 centuries. We're going to go down in history, whether we like it or not, I'm afraid, as the generations that consumed and destroyed and squandered the supply of fuels and minerals which could have been shared with humans for millions of years to come. I hang my head in shame. The ethics of this overuse, I think, are clear. If our overuse is not actually stealing, then it certainly is coveting something that is not ours. The commandments tell us clearly that it's a sin against God's law to do so. The church as an institution and we as individual Christians ought to be leading the movement to change this national disgrace. Jesus Christ, during his brief ministry on earth, preached against the evils of his day, and I'm certain if he were here on the earth today, he'd be preaching against the squander of our natural resources. Well, we're kind of at a turning point now, and I think the future of mankind depends sort of on how soon we turn things around and realize that the resources that are here on the earth are not ours to use entirely as we like.
All right. Well, let's see. I went to Dad's presentation the other day and saw a couple graphs that really interested me. This was one of them. He used it to illustrate, well, a couple different things show up on it. I'll just talk about that first. On the bottom is energy use per capita, per population, the quantity of energy use. And on the top is per gross national product. So the ones on that line are about as efficient in their use of energy as the USA. And some are more and some are less efficient. But I guess what amazed me is the fact that here's these civilized countries right here, you know, good countries that we visited, and life seems to be good. And here's the United States, way up here in quantity of energy consumption per person, twice as high as anybody else. And
the whole third world is down in the corner there where we didn't have enough space to write the names.
Dad and I were talking in the car, and he sees that we have to address the problem of sort of the third world, how we're going to tell them they can't use as much as we have. I guess when I see graphs like this, what strikes me is the problem in the world is not to serve everybody. The problem is America. The problem is the United States. I mean, we can talk about the other nations overpopulating, but the impact of one American on the resources of the world is about 50 times that of the impact of one individual in an underdeveloped or developing nation. So I really think that we have to begin with the problem as looking at ourselves. And as we're going to talk about a little bit later, ask you to talk about, I think the problem, well, a huge problem is our standard of living, which has increased during the 70s still in this decade when supposedly we've been thinking about energy. It's increased a lot, our use of energy. And the thing is, I guess I feel like most of you probably agree with me that we can't continue at this standard of living. It's a phenomenally high standard of living. As we were driving out, we pulled into one gas station that was pushing conservation, and their motto in the gas station was, leave one car home one day a week. That was going to be their big way to save energy, leave one car home one day a week.
But I think the other thing that Graf says is you can have the same standard of living and use half as much.
Well, half as much, but that makes a very small dent in, you know. Yeah, we can, by efficiency, we can move over on the graph. And we should, of course.
Anyway, I guess I think, you know, that whole notion, first of all, that most families now have two cars, but that you're just the idea that you're driving these two cars 7 days a week, so kind of your little contribution to conservation is leave one of those two cars home one day a week. I just think, how do we possibly get to a point like this? It's disastrous. I mean, it's such a high standard of living. I think David Messenbrink's presentation is talking about sort of the white South African standard of living being so incredibly high because it's built on the sweat of the rest of the population. It just struck me the similarities between those South Africans and us in the United States, although our cheap labor isn't living right here in this country, so we don't see them maybe as much, but that we are just living at too high a standard of living, and that's got to stop. Dad asked me to cite some biblical evidence, but I think he's already cited ample, which is the commandments, the 9th and 10th, you shall not covet. I mean, the reason we have such a higher standard of living, or part of it, is that we covet everything that everybody else has and have to have that. And then another one, you know, it's debatable, but I think it's true that we're stealing. We're going against that commandment, you shall not steal. In our use of resources, we're stealing from future generations, if not from our brothers and sisters around the world. So I think the problem is very serious. I guess I feel like most of you probably agree with that, with the necessity of conservation in a hurry. We've got to be changing our standard of living, our whole way of life, rapidly, very soon. I think I believe that I think I've believed it for a few years, but I guess the perspective that I wanted to address it from tonight is what you do in congregations. Because I think, you know, each one of us that comes to hold, maybe we could sort of drop out of society or whatever and live our own little simple life. And I, you know, just having gotten out of college and everything, that's of course what I always thought that you were supposed to do. But now I see more that if real changes are to happen, that congregations are important and sort of the rest of the people in America who are at least nominally Christian, if not more Christian than that, how do you start convincing people, or how do you start acting differently as a church, as a body of Christ? The reason I'm thinking so congregation-oriented now is that I just got done with a year of internship in a parish in a small town in Minnesota, very nice parish, good people, just average Minnesota people, although Larry would probably want to do that. And so I tried some energy things. You know, I tried to communicate to people that I really believe that the gospel calls us to a different lifestyle in terms of resource consumption. I think maybe I was able to reach a few people, but I think basically it was a failure. Not that I wasn't liked and stuff, but I don't think I made a dent in anybody's consciousness, really. I tried some things like, I tried to wear as many clothes that I had gotten at rummage sales as possible, and whenever somebody in the congregation had a rummage sale, I went to it. I tried to convince me, there's nothing wrong with wearing secondhand things, because I really believe that, you know, standard of living, well, everything that you buy, every new thing has taken energy to make it. It's very clear. And so if we can use old things over, that's all the better. I think they were highly embarrassed when I would show up at one of their... Whenever I went to somebody's house, I tried to wear a thing that I had gotten at their rummage sale. But couple other things that I tried that were failures. Also, I rode my bike, and people seemed like that. I tried, because I really think that driving around in town, it adds up to more miles than we would ever believe. Now, Dad says, you know, oh, Barbara, look at how much gasoline we blew on this trip out west driving out. Yeah, I think that's true. You know, it's a luxury trip in a way, but driving around town is what eats up the gas in my car. So I tried to ride my bike everywhere, and they like that. But most everything that I did was a failure on that score.
Barb, I happened to live in the same town Barb did. And I remember that you raised the question in the fall, and one of the pastors who was at the meeting said it later. Barb said, what are we going to do in winter with all these big churches we're heating? Are we looking at any way of conserving some energy? And one of them said later, you know, she raised our consciousness a lot. Asking those questions.
Yeah.
Okay, well, maybe.
Wait a minute. I want to talk to failure over there. You know, from another person, and being outside the Lutheran parish, we could get more feedback probably. But I thought you knew this stuff. Well, tell them what's different with your home, with your rectory, your parish center.
Okay.
Tell them.
I went on internship in a congregation that always had two pastors, so they had two large parsonages. Mine was four bedrooms. I was living all by myself, so I got some roommates. Is that what you're here?
Okay,
stuff like that. Yeah, okay.
But Barbara, the male clergy in that town, as well as a number of the parishioners, gave us the feedback that you might have thought you weren't touching them. I assume that you knew that. The consciences were being pricked, people were questioning, they were discussing that they were obviously uncomfortable because they were used to a lot of these kinds of luxuries. And yet they liked you, and they knew you weren't any dummy, and they knew you were a good woman, and so they had to wrestle with that. And I think failure, you were not. I think that you moved through there and touched a lot of people's consciousness, and I think that's what it's all about. So would you please drop that from your left?
All right. Well, see, I'm using it for rhetorical purposes. Well, one thing I tried, I had that book, you know, the Alternative Celebrations Catalog. I don't know, I'd really recommend that book to you about sort of how much money we spend on Christmas and all these holidays and sort of alternative ways to celebrate. And come Advent time, I started saying, you know, let's celebrate St. Nicholas, all the things in the book. Let's celebrate St. Nicholas Day and be like St. Nicholas instead of like Santa Claus and all these things. Well, the president of the congregation, Jack Jost, runs the hardware store in town. He just came up to me and said, Barbara, I'm sick and tired. Every year it comes around Christmas, the preachers are always saying, you know, don't buy so much stuff. Well, I'm not going to make it if people don't buy a lot of stuff around Christmas. My livelihood depends on Christmas buying. So would you quit it? And just that kind of reaction from you. I mean, I guess I don't know how you can present these issues in congregations so that people will listen, or I don't know what. I mean, he really believes, and I guess what everybody hit me with that really kind of hurt, or I didn't know what to say, was sort of, well, that's not the American way. That was one of them. You know, that's really not the American way, and America's a Christian country. And second of all, why you preachers are always talking about such negative stuff? Why do we always have to hear such bad things, such negative things about our country, about our church, about our life? Why can't we hear some good things? And sort of that is an adequate kind of criticism for sort of like, make the energy crisis go away. It's a bad thing. We don't want to hear that. I don't know. I just felt like there were a lot of unresolved things and that I was very frustrated with these kinds of issues in the congregation. So that's what I'd kind of like to ask you people. How would you go about presenting sort of the necessity of conservation in a gospel context to other people or in a church? You know, if we believe that this is Christ's call, like to the rich young man, he said, go sell your goods, go to a lower standard of living. Zacchaeus, same way, when he touched his life, he gave away half his stuff, lived more simply. It seems so obvious.
Go to one paycheck?
Okay. Now we're coming to the controversial point. Dad believes that part of the reason for, and I agree, I mean, I think it's true, part of the reason for such an increase in the standard of living in the 70s was that so many women went to work.
Well, not necessarily that the women went to work, but that families now have come to depend on two paychecks. The you know, if you go back in history, you think, oh, well, you know, back 50 or 100 years ago, people didn't use nearly the amount of energy that we do now. But in fact, there isn't much difference between 1850 and 1950 in the per capita use of energy in the United States. We've always been an extremely energy-intensive country from the time that the first white settlers set foot on the soil. And I suppose, actually, if you get right down to it, the per capita use by the Indians was very high because there weren't very many people there. It's just that the energy use has grown as the population has grown. But there's, on this graph of per capita energy use, there's a rather dramatic increase in the 60s and early 70s. And that is largely attributed to the very rapid growth in the labor force. The fact that the average family went from one paycheck to two paychecks. And if you've got two paychecks, you're going to spend it on something. And as Barb said, essentially everything you buy takes energy to create, some more than others. But all goods take a lot of energy.
So what do you people think?
I would just wonder if that couldn't be another good thing of looking at sexism at the same time, and maybe seeing a way to look at our whole labor force in terms of alternative labor forces, that maybe we look at flexible time, and maybe both men and women don't need to be into the capitalistic kind of building up competition in their own careers, so that maybe men work part-time and women work part-time, and there's different kinds of ways of childcare, that we need to look at some new ways of energizing our male-female population, that the women who are coming into the workforce don't have to imitate the men, and the men can get out of some of those traps. Good conversation.
Oh, yeah, topic. Don't raise your hand.
I think when you're going into any kind of lifestyle change, the important thing is to look at it as a joyous experience, a freeing kind of thing, and to have fun with it. Particularly in our society with all the pressure with advertising, if you can take that, look at it, realize what you're doing, and laugh at it, it makes it an awful lot easier than going into it with an attitude that you're trying to do without, and you have to force yourself to. You know, if you're looking at it that you're going to be hurt and you have to have less, instead of realizing that in the end you're going to have more. I think that's the thing that makes the big difference for me, the attitude you go into it with.
You know, and I think that is so hard to do when you're by yourself. I guess I really came this year to believe the first step maybe has to be that congregations become more community. I mean, I just found, I never would have thought of buying a house. I mean, I just bought a car not even a year ago, and here I was out in Hutchinson, and everybody's talking about it, everybody my age, you know, buying their house, getting enough money to make a down payment. I mean, of course, I'm not thinking of doing it now because I'm not in Hutchinson anymore. But, you know, just, I felt how much pressure there is of everybody else doing this. Therefore, somehow, you know, if you don't buy a house, there you are going to be thrown out, you know, and live in the streets or something. So, I mean, and just sort of that insidious pressure of if everybody else is doing it one way, how difficult it is to sort of have that jubilant feeling about any other way. You feel like you're going to end up in the gutter.
I'll just make a couple of comments. One, I may be wrong, but it seems to me that to some extent over the next 5 to 10 years, and I think it's really started in a big way already. I think there's a lot of pressures that are building and have already built that are starting to make changes that, as I look at it, maybe in a way will partially take care of what we're talking about. To my mind, the dollar speaks very loudly. And I see, for example, a lot of institutions, public institutions now, undertaking energy audits and energy conservation matters, measures. I know just in our own community, all of the major public buildings, schools, hospitals, churches, are starting to take a look at the kind of energy they're using. insulation, thermal paint, converting oil to electric, you know, any number of oil energy conservation measures, because they all are hit with the economics of, you know, what it takes to run a physical plant. I'm amazed to see now the number of small cars in use. It's been very interesting, and I know everybody's aware of the pain that's going on in the auto industry right now to see the downsizing of automobiles. And I don't think it's over yet by any means. We're going to see a lot more change just in the cars that we drive. Go through a parking lot and count the number of average American-sized cars versus small automobiles you see now. And I think you'd be surprised to see what's occurring. So I think in a large part, I think economics is dictating the change. Paul Harvey got a kick out of commenting this past week that a car has now been developed, an electric car with 155-mile driving range now, that's being mass-produced, I believe, down south, North Carolina, South Carolina, hopefully out in a couple of years. And I just see that kind of thing in industry occurring now, and I'm personally very optimistic and hopeful about that. I see the aluminum industry now able to recycle far more aluminum than they ever did, say, just 5 years ago. I think there's another side of this, too, though. I spent 2 years in the Peace Corps in South America living with some of the poorest people I could ever have imagined in a slum area, and we were required to live in a slum. And one of the things that struck me was, and maybe it relates to what you're talking about, I took for granted what the United States is. And up until I had gone overseas and lived in poverty and seen people wondering where the next meal was coming from, and small kids whose breakfast consisted of a cup of tea and a piece of bread if they could find it. That was a real shock to me, because I just kind of assumed in my naivety that much of the rest of the world, for whatever I had read in National Geographic or seen on TV, more or less enjoyed much the same standards that we in our country do. And I think part of the graft, the lack of impact in the graft, is that most Americans proceed somehow in the notion that everybody else, in other words, we have taken for granted our standard of living. Particularly my generation, I came along, you know, after the 40s. I never experienced the Depression. I have no idea what the Depression was like. Folks can describe it to me, but I'm sure that's different than being there. So part of the problem to me, and I can see it differently now only because I've lived with people who made less than $100 a year per capita income and had to survive on that. But most Americans have never had the privilege, and I count it a privilege, to have seen what the rest of humanity has to go through on a day-to-day basis in order to exist. And it's very easy to take this country for granted. Our standard of living, each other, transportation, roads, water that we can drink, for granted. And to me, seeing made all the difference in my attitudes towards this. And I don't know if that, how you impart that.
Seems crucial to me that in one non-renewable energy source, in oil, that the United States has to stop subsidizing the cost of gasoline. 3 years ago, when we moved to Los Angeles and I started commuting, I thought, this city will never be able to survive if gasoline becomes more expensive. And now, as I've seen in the last year, as gasoline become more expensive, I think even that city could survive with a radical change in lifestyle. But to do it, gasoline has to get more expensive. Just, it's been interesting the last year to see what's happened. As gas has gone from 55 cents to $1.20. More people are riding buses. More people are carpooling.
But how do you convince people that it's a good thing for gas to go up? I guess we've talked about it, because we both believe in that 50-cent gas tax.
Twice President Carter has tried to get a 50-cent per gallon tax, which I think is much too small. I think it should have been a dollar or more. And twice, it hasn't even gotten off the ground. There hasn't been And I don't know, maybe that isn't an appropriate thing for the for the minister to urge his parishioners to support, to show that their congressman that everyone in the district isn't against this. But I tend to think it is.
It's a tragedy that we're spending $1.20 for gas in the United States and people in Europe are spending $3.
Yeah. But in America, we're just not willing to accept anything that that infringes on our sacred automobiles.
One of the unacceptabilities of talking about reducing a standard of living might be in the assumption, this is just, I'm just throwing this out for you, is that when you people throw this saying a lower standard of living, they're assuming a lower quality of living. And I think that's, there's a very big distinction there. And if you're asking for a role of the congregation, there's an issue that you can get directly at.
Yeah, I agree. This trip out was very interesting. I was listening to a radio broadcast, some kind of poll, I didn't catch whose it was, but of the American population, and was asking, are you happier now than you were 10 years ago? And of course everybody said no. And then they asked the reason, and the majority of the people, it was an actual majority of the people cited as the reason the decline of the tight economy. Well, I mean, if people think that they're unhappy because the bad economy, and yet our standard of living is even higher now than it ever was before, what does that mean? I mean, it's like our wants are insatiable. The only thing that makes people happy is an even better economy than one that's in so many ways so good. I mean, they think their buying power isn't enough and that's what's making them unhappy. I don't know what you do.
Rather than talking about lowering one's standard of living, in congregations, I think it would work a little easier to talk about what makes up quality lifestyle. You know, and go at it not a lowering seems negative, giving up, but talking about quality lifestyle changing is a positive new because we are so frustrated with all the rush and stuff like that. It'd be another way of getting at the same thing.
And what kinds of things would you do?
Well, I think a lot of times, I don't know, another thought's coming in my mind, I don't know how it's related, but Robert Lifton talks about that the number one problem with neurosis in America today is psychological numbing. That we are numb to reality and we try to hide from it or not feel, not get in contact with really the evils or the problems or the joys of the world. We are just blah to it or numb to it. And so one way would be just to find out, I suppose, and ask questions, you know, what excites you about life? What, you know, human relationships, sharing things together and all these sorts of things.
I'd like to build on that, or another suggestion, another example. And it comes straight from looking back at Europe, because to me Europe represents a lower standard of living, yet equally high in quality, if not higher in quality, in terms of a lifestyle. And there's a little back history here. Europe's been faced with resource shortages for hundreds of years. The United States is only just beginning to face that now. And so Europe is a nice way to kind of glance back. But also, in tying it back into what he was saying, and also tying it back to what Mary said at Vespers, is you're talking about quality of living and some specific examples how to improve that. You know, what she said about dancing and singing in terms of replacement of electronic entertainments and things like this. Like, lots of room to go in subjects like that.
Another thing, too, that I think is annoying is continual talk about simple lifestyle and you lose sight of why you're talking about simple lifestyle. And I know I numbed myself. Simplicity for the sake of simplicity gets tedious after a while. But when it is the byproduct of something else, it follows naturally when you begin thinking of aligning yourself with the poor or when you believe that certain injustices go along with a certain kind of lifestyle and that justice can only be accomplished or wrought by living a different way. Then the simplicity comes, then the conservation comes. And it's not always
because you're just thinking about simplicity. And so those are very much biblical issues that can be raised in a congregation.
If you take, for example, again, using the singing and dancing thing, if you bring people in on that, let them see how much fun and how much joy there is in that. It's far better than sitting watching your TV at night. You've taken it a positive line and you're getting it.
I think coupled with the joy, though, we are called to a radical conversion. And myself seemed to me spend the last few months dealing in a really direct way with that. I don't even know what we want to call it anymore, that money-monger society. But I do see a real need for a radical conversion. I don't know exactly where it goes, but I certainly feel that for myself and for the people I've seen.
How do you answer Barb's hardware friend? That attitude is echoed over and over again. My livelihood depends upon it. Our jobs depend upon it.
The American way depends.
Well, yeah, but how do you answer? You can't come down. He's saying I don't want to bear the brunt of this lifestyle change.
Seems that's a place for the whole congregation to be really come together. That the reason that guy's going to feel a brunt is because he's stocked a certain way, and he's stocked a certain way because of a consumer pattern. Well, if we're going to change those consumer patterns, we have a responsibility to that person not to be left in the lurch. And that's a place where a congregation can find some alternatives and support that merchant.
Like how?
Somebody take over.
But in fact, is if we all consume less, I suspect we're going to need fewer merchants.
Although those people have to find jobs somewhere else, and I think that we all underestimate how many people there are that are directly responsible for producing all these things that we want, from automobiles, to stereo sets, cameras, tape players, everything, that if we lower our standard of living, we don't consume so much, a lot of those people we put out to work, and we'll have to find some other way to keep themselves and their families housed and fed. And right now we don't have anything in our, or a place in our society to put those people, and that's, I think, what we're going to have to find.
Well, unfortunately, every change in, or virtually every change in industry in the past several decades has been to substitute cheap energy for expensive labor. And I think we can very well reverse this trend a little bit and try to increase the amount of labor that goes into manufacture certain goods and decrease energy.
People, though, I think they've been kind of synthesized against working them, really working themselves when they can have a machine do it for them. And it's going to take a lot of effort on those people's parts to assume the responsibility to do the work with other people themselves. Although I think when they start doing that, working more with other people, they'll find that that's a very enjoyable experience. They may well be happier while making something, putting something together with other people.
Any farmers in the group? The change, to me at least, is very dramatic on the farm. One man and a huge tractor are doing the work. Are doing the work of five or six people when I used to work on the farm. The other four people have joined the labor force in the city.
And the increase in energy use on the farm is so phenomenal. I remember visiting my sister in her internship congregation 2 years ago, and we went around and visited some of the farmers. And they had just gotten the REA in about, it was after the war, so they didn't get electricity until maybe 48 or 49. And he took us around. He was so proud. I've managed to increase my use of energy tenfold in the last decade, and aren't I progressing? And he was going, oh. Because, he remembered within his own lifetime how he had used a farm without electricity or anything, and he was just so proud that he's electrified everything.
But then we're going to have to be willing to pay more for food.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
Absolutely.
And then it touches every one of us.
Right.
because if we're going to put four families back on the farm, I have a brother who's trying to farm, you know, in this generation of trying to start now as a small farmer by himself. And I don't see how he could do it. That's not the lifestyle he wants, but I don't think he can economically make it.
Yeah.
Is he in hog farming?
That's what he's been trying to do.
Yeah, that's the price are so low now.
But it doesn't make any difference. I mean, any of the small farmers, if you don't have a father's farm to inherit of several hundred acres.
Wouldn't there be some economic change in farming if the trend were away from that great big equipment that, you know, is $50,000 for the front tires and it's an exorbitant piece? If one was maybe sharing equipment with another farm and buying less expensive equipment because you're not farming at the same scale with fewer people. I mean, it seems like there'd be a shift that economics would change that way.
Well, the other thing, too, that we're looking at is that very few people realize that our present agricultural system is oil-based. Mm-hmm. And it's actually an industrial agricultural system. And that's going to face a drastic change.
Yeah, I that alarms me a lot. I tend to agree with you, though, that prices are going to have to go up a lot. I mean, the farmers in my congregation that I talk to, I say, well, why do you plow in the fall when you know that that's going to cause so much more erosion? Or why so many chemicals and everything? Or why not rotate the crops instead of using so many herbicides and stuff? And it's all, the prices are so low, we can't afford to switch crops around. Or we can't afford to do what we think we should.
Aren't there examples of farmers that are doing well? I'm thinking of perhaps the Amish or something that have some economically feasible farms and are, I don't know how much they sell outside of their own community, but aren't there examples of economically feasible farms that are not petroleum-based?
Mm-hmm. But their income is below a level that's acceptable to most people in agriculture. Agribusiness, I guess, is the term you use now. It really isn't farming, it's agribusiness. The land is just the catalyst that receives the chemicals.
One of the things, I think, in terms of what you said, un-American, is when you start talking energy conservation and it starts smacking of coming into collision with the capitalistic system. If resources run as such, I'm thinking oil and oil-based agriculture right now, which means that agriculture is shifting now to capital investment, capital-based instead of labor-intensive. Right. If resources run as such, that it's going to be more economical under the capitalistic system to go back to labor-intensive, then it's going to swing back to be American to go to labor, to energy conservation. Mm-hmm.
Do you have any ideas of what you can actually either do when you go back to your congregation or of your congregation actually doing something in this so that we can kind of get down to not the theoretical aspects but the practical ones of what we might do?
Are you thinking to get people motivated or once they're motivated, specific things to do?
Either way.
One thing I was thinking when we were talking about, you know, the whole agribusiness, deciding to pay more for something, to buy from the small farmer, the co-op, that type of thing. Their competition with the big corporations, which own the large percent of our farm area, is just incredible. And they need consumer support to, you know, even stay alive. I think that's one big thing, you know, that we can do in that area. And that's a hard decision because it usually means paying much higher prices. But I don't know, there's a line in the book, Enough is Enough, that talks about saying no to something precisely because the price is too low, because it means somebody's suffering, whether it's cheap labor or it gets really complicated. But I think that's one thing we can do.
I think one thing has been it's always struck me really poignantly has been, and you know, my work for other people too, and that is we spend so little percentage of our income on food compared to developing countries and even other developed countries, that, you know, it's incredible. I don't know, you know, exactly what I spend on food, but maybe it's 10-15% of my income, or maybe 20%. But I assure you, if you go to Peru or Indonesia or something, people are spending 90% of their income or 90% of their time out of the year just in gathering or producing food for them to sustain themselves on, which leaves very little time, of course, for arts and other things. And I think that
yeah, I guess I agree, but, you know, I think I'm just thinking of my congregation, if I went back there and we asked the question, you know, take a little poll during the sermon time or something, how many, well, of course they wouldn't raise your hand, so you'd have to do it the other way, but how many of you in this room, yeah, you can do it, how many of you in this room think that food prices are too high? Up would go all the hands. Everybody thinks food prices are too high. And then you ask, how many people think gas prices are too high? Oh, everybody's hand would go up on that too. I don't know how, you know, even though we've got farmers in the congregation, I think people think everything's too expensive, and it's just incredible.
Isn't the problem, though, I think, you know, we're sometimes trapped into largeness is where it's at. And to have any sort of plans in the congregation, we have to involve everybody in it, rather than, you know, the model, small is beautiful, to really take a look at, there's a few people, I think, in every congregation that must, maybe not the hardware store person, but there might be enough people that are struggling with this and agonizing over it, that you can pull them together. Because I know if there's not somebody that's looking over my shoulder and asking me, why do you want to buy that? I would probably buy a lot more. And if we have a kind of a consumer anonymous group that we have to say get permission from them or something before you purchase something. Although I have a love hate for that type of thing. I know I need it. I'm addicted.
It seems to me, though, that the only person I can really change is myself. It'd be nice if I could change the congregation. Now, how many of us, for example, would be willing to pool rides, you know, if we want to go on a trip, pool rides, give up our televisions for a year, you know, just have them there, we're not watching them, so we're cutting down on electricity. I think a lot of those things that sort of we're not willing ourselves to give the example for, it's always kind of nice to say the farmer should do it or big business should do it or whatever, but I guess I know in my own religious community, if you know, we don't each have a car, but if we have 10 people living in a house and they all share a car, well, it takes a lot of juggling and so on to do, but that is done. And like Barb, as you did, how many of us who have an extra bedroom would be willing to say, I have an extra bedroom, does someone want to use it this winter? You know, I know that that would be a hard thing to do, but at least that some practicalities that we could do, it seems to me.
I've sometimes defined energy conservation as getting the other fellow to give up his favorite luxury.
Yeah.
Like I was saying, you know, like we talked on the way out here, we can be very self-righteous. I do without this and that, but a lot of other people have. But I have this yen to travel, but I'm going halfway around the world, and it uses up an awful lot of energy. And so we've all got our own pet ways of using energy. I suppose one of the things that would have the most immediate impact in some ways is lowering our expectations for housing. The average house it keeps getting bigger all the time. When we started out married life and people in my generation, the standard first house was a 500 or 600 square foot two bedroom house. I haven't seen any of those built for years and years. Nobody lives in them anymore unless you're way down below the poverty line. You know, our expectations have just in how we live or where we live have just been going up. The lot size in every city, I'm sure, is expanding.
I wonder if Southern California, no matter what we say about it, the rest of the world country, is saying something to the United States, though. just economics coming into play for young families.
Mm-hmm.
With Ruth and I going into our late 20s and myself being a member of a profession that usually in most communities physicians have big homes and everything, if we stayed in Los Angeles, I don't think we could ever get into the housing market with no equity up to this point. And even if most of my friends who have gotten, you know, take two loans from both sets of parents and that's the way to make their down payment, they go condominium route, smaller is better, and the European route, doesn't everybody isn't going to have their own lot in our generation, I don't think. I think finally we're going to start looking at how Europe has housed people for a long, long time. But boy, people don't like it.
You know, I guess I think it makes such a difference whether you do it by necessity. In a way, I'm really grateful for the energy crisis too, but I think that America, if we start getting to feel like we're really having to hold on to all we have and hoard it, sort of like those white people in South Africa, I mean, in that movie, I guess it will be shown again this week, but you know, they're desperate people trying to cling to that way of life that's so obviously wrong for that country. If we start feeling that way, that's going to be disastrous, whereas, you know, if we can somehow biblically or whatever give it up in order to share with other people and establish more equality. But yeah, I agree with you. I think it's, in a way, a blessing that all this has come along.
I don't think it's an if or not. I think that's the way we live. We live clutching
desperate
and greedy. And I think that goes back several decades.
And isn't the problem already taking place? If we have to be forced into smaller homes by shortages, aren't we indeed stealing? You know, if the energy is gone, that we have to live in those small houses, you know, and we can, you know, be joyous about that. But don't we have thoughts of some covetous or some stealing or something else? I heard you say, Barbara, start to say that wouldn't it be so much better if we didn't do it out of necessity, but we did it out of the goodness of our hearts.
Or maybe not the goodness of our hearts, but the fear and trembling of being, you know, standing in judgment someday. We're all going to have to. And I think congregations, again, trying to go back to this, I can't change anybody else, and I don't know the timing of my own changes, but I need to keep hearing and learning some of the connections that the United States has had throughout the world as far as getting its resources through pretty insidious means, I believe. Congregations, probably the best thing is to just begin by general education. That's threatening enough at the beginning. And people on their own time schedules perhaps will feel the prick and start feeling some change happening. But, you know, I don't know if it's a goodness of the heart thing or just being convicted that, man, I better do some changing because I'm stealing and I'm a
stealer. I think that's where the community comes into it and has support. I think particularly, you know, in a Christian community, we have to support each other. You have to understand that we've all grown up in that society of wants. I think back to my congregation at home and how often, as soon as you go to somebody's house for something, the comments are, oh, what a lovely home. You know, we see so much of our own acceptance in what we have. And I think we have to learn to support each other just as the person. If we can start doing that for each other in our congregation, and then get together in small groups, maybe talk about, you know, just how we feel, how frustrating it gets sometimes to constantly see the costs of meat going up or whatever. And to look at that, to realize that everybody's experiencing that same thing, and then to realize that, you know, the one way you can overcome that is to make more money so you can afford it. The other way is to say, hey, I don't need it. And if we can, you know, look at that and realize those feelings together, I think then you start to make the change because you want to. And that's where that freeing kind of feeling comes in. But I think that support is really important. You can make people feel guilty, and the guilt will last maybe a week. And then they start to get tired of feeling guilty, and you tend to just forget it.
I wonder if another thing that needs to be done then is education of all of us about the subtleties of building things. I mean, building cars or anything else is like
making a cake in some respects. You dump in all these ingredients and it comes out, it doesn't look anything like the manganese and the chrome and the copper and stuff that went into it. We don't have any, most of us don't have any conception of where these things come from and how limited they are becoming. We, all we know about is oil. We don't know anything about it, all the other things that are being used there.
Yeah.
In our congregation at home, there is a group in response to what you said about a small support group to get, you know, plant the seed called the Order of St. Martin that meets weekly. And part of their goal is self-education. They show films, pass books around, have a collective library on all of these topics. And then they're trying to put a lot of things in action. There's always a sharing list so that if you have a sewing machine and your neighbor wants to sew, doesn't want to buy a new sewing machine, your sewing machine is her sewing machine. And your gardening tools are their gardening tools. They've shared collective gardens, and they're not a very big group, and they're not a very popular group, because they're committed. You know, it isn't, the only reason they meet is because of their commitments. And that is one thing that can work, I think. And then occasionally you'll see in the bulletin that they are having an open meeting for people who want to find out what this Order of St. Martin has been in the bulletin for. You know, but then you're welcome to come and meet and grow and plant a few more seeds. But there are groups like that starting.
Dorothy, I think another education thing, I really refer to what you're saying about that way of getting at it is, is my own bias, that, you know, the whole thing of self-esteem. I believe that our capitalistic society is built on a lot of my not feeling good about myself. So in order to have the approval of everybody else, I buy another car and I have a bigger home and I have the newest fashion. I couldn't possibly go to this party tonight or whatever without these things on my back. And so as I can feel better about myself and say no to more and more of those kinds of things. So I would see that as another educational approach to say. But then we're really questioning the whole American way of life. You know, don't we need capitalism? You know, I don't think we do. But we're really talking about a whole radical change. But that is something that's within the power of each one of us to do.
Well, it seems that we're saying, and I think an answer to here, or trying to answer the question of what can we do, it's that having examples and models and having people that are willing to be demonstrate this kind of existence and this kind of life and its meaningfulness for them. I know it's helpful for me, even just being here and being aware of the many that are involved and the kind of affirmations that they can make about it, it is helpful, and it takes special courage and special strength on the part of those that are especially in the forefront and willing to step out that way. But I know I'm grateful, and the support that you speak, we all need and are grateful for that, but some probably will have to dare live out that support around them. But I think that's probably one of the most effective ways that can be done. I think I'd rather not try to make people feel guilty if they aren't doing it within the congregation, and that's always a danger, you know. I suppose there's a point in which you have to recognize the wrongness about some of these things. But
I have a question. When I go home in August, I will have been at Holden a year. And this is a question about the church as an institution, but I'll walk back into my church where I serve, and it's a massive building, and not one window in the entire building opens, because it's all
air conditioned, climate control.
And then I'll be met by hundreds of styrofoam cups. This will be just as we're having cake and cookies and things. And how do I go back into that situation without being a kind of a self-righteous, arrogant prophet? And I guess it's a much deeper question. How do we help people see? Because it's not a matter of being confronted with facts, it's being confronted with a vision. That's hard. I'm not asking for answers, I'm just saying it's a problem.
Be the vision and be self-righteous, and I mean, the world needs examples. People will follow them if they if they see that you're having, you're enjoying themselves without having all the things that everybody else is having.
I'd speak from my own personal experience there. I've spent most of my time working out in the woods. The summer's up at Lyman Lake. It's an entirely different lifestyle. And I can honestly say when people, I talk to people, they start asking questions, and most of those questions are immediately aimed at the lifestyle. They're not interested in all the fancy Forest Service garbage. They want to know how I live up there and how I react. And when my eyes light up and I start talking, you will not believe the effect it has on those folks. All of a sudden, I turn around and say, but I don't make very much money. And they say, oh, that doesn't matter. They all say that. But you turn around and ask them to try to survive on what I mean. But they get a vision, a dream, something. It's very infectious.
You know, Harvey Cox, for what he's worth, said some good things. And what one was in the Feast of Fools, that world changers must learn also to be world celebrators. And you know, you got to keep that balance. And I think part of the visionary sort of thing is to really know what you're about and what you need to celebrate and celebrate it. And then the change will have its perspective too. And I don't think that's the same as copying out and not saying or not doing what you need to do, but rejoicing in those things that need to be rejoiced.
Dan, I think you, knowing you as a person just briefly now, I think you'll bring it out very clearly in worship opportunities too.
Mm-hmm.
And that speaks very strongly and mightily. Maybe you can encourage people to bring their own coffee cups to services next week for a coffee hour after service.
But the cups are free there. They're from Lutheran Brotherhood. Yes.
Now we're getting to the real problem.
It's
part of their fraternity.
How do you say thank you?
We focused almost entirely on what we do as individual, or the example we set, and I certainly agree heartily that that's the place to start, by example. But I wonder if to what extent should the church itself get involved trying to change the laws of the land and so on to change our national way of squandering? Or isn't that appropriate? Are we now back to doing things that aren't appropriate for the church as an institution to do?
I think what David's been saying all week, the church has to have a role in how we live, and whether it's race relations in South Africa or the United States, or whether it's energy in the United States. I think the church has to be involved.
And I sort of feel that way too, although I remember at our district convention, which I went to, it was my first one I went to in April, from our church we could have two clergy, it was the pastor and then two lay delegates, and there were a couple resolutions up, like one was about Nestle's and one was South Africa. These weren't conservation resolutions really, but you know, they were resolutions that had to do with our role in the world and things like that, social resolutions. And all three delegates, the pastor, especially the two lay delegates, were really, really opposed to those kinds of resolutions. I mean, I think most people don't agree that that is the role of the church, to speak out on any kind of national policy or those kind of issues. Although I think most of us here believe that is a function of the gospel. Not a function, it's part of the gospel, is to believe in the place for everyone in the whole human family and God's vision. And if we're part of the body is hurting another part, that's not good.
It just seems to me that in our own church and in our own denomination, you see a lot preached how can I say it, as a layperson in an overall sense, in a theological sense. But rarely, and I mean rarely, do I hear or do we hear sermons that talk about taking the gospel and translating it into practical, everyday reality, where most of the rest of us are, with examples and specifics that most of us on a day-to-day, day-in, day-out, work-a-day, family, husband, wife, kids, job basis can relate to. And it seems to me that in talking about stewardship and conservation in a Christian context, it's very important to be able to talk to people, so to speak, eyeball to eyeball, about bread and butter, you know, Christianity, and not some overview theological vision of what conservation for the Christian means. I don't know if I'm relating to anyone, but to me, being able to translate it into day-to-day specifics is very useful.
Could you volunteer as a member of a parish, Buck, to, I hate to use the word committee, but, you know, to gather together or to facilitate even such a discussion as this within your own parish and try to, you know, put it into day-to-day language?
Yes, I certainly think so. And I think in many ways these issues come up in our, you know, group meetings and so forth now, but I don't know that they come up as in a Christian
context. No, that's what you're saying.
That's
you
the
know,
difference. You know, conservation is something we do because Jimmy Carter and Department of Energy and Ralph Nader and others say we should do. But Christ said conservation? Now, come on. You know, this is a Christian issue.
Even the term stewardship rings money,
yeah.
You know, and that's a whole distorted view of, you know, what stewardship is all about.
I think part of the problem too is we can't imagine it. We've got to think of God as kind of this unlimited giver in the sense of blessings means more and more things, and it's hard to imagine that God would create a world with limits to it or with ends to the resources. I mean, we can't. We don't really think of God as creating limits, really. I mean, I think it has to be a whole new vision of who God is, what blessing means, and all those kinds of things that we've come to think of more.
Can I bring up, this is a good time to perhaps those of you who, don't need to stay, I like to, or I don't feel I've done my job, I guess, if I have pointed out, reminded you about the ways that growth can take place. To a mathematician, it's a matter of linear growth, quadratic growth, or exponential growth. Can I put that slide on? I wasn't going to repeat the talk from the other day, but I really feel it's worthwhile doing it. A friend of mine calls this the unforgotten or the forgotten fundamentals of the energy crisis. The fact that in a finite, in any kind of a finite limit, if you get into an exponential growth, you're in trouble. And it doesn't matter how big the limits of the system are, it's going to go unstable. Now, by exponential growth, I mean when the rate of growth is proportional to the amount of anything that's already there, like compound interest. For instance, supposing you're saving money. You start out putting 10 cents in the bank every month. In a linear growth system, you keep on putting 10 cents in the bank, and your bank balance goes up 10, 20, 30, 40, so on. At the end of the year, you've got $1.20 in the bank. In a quadratic system, the rate of growth increases steadily. That is, you put 10 cents in the bank the first month, 20 the second, 30 the third, and you end up with $7.80 at the end of the first year. But in an exponential growth, you double the amount you put in each month. You put in 10 cents the first month, 20 the second, 40 the next month. In other words, the amount that you're putting in the bank is always proportional to what's already there. Now, many systems naturally tend toward an exponential growth. Bacteria or plant growth. If growth is left unchecked, why, sooner or later, the population is going to exceed any kind of limits that you set. For instance, supposing you take an example bacteria in a bottle. You say, all right, the bacteria multiply by dividing a cell into two cells. And supposing that on the average they do that every minute. All right, I put one bacterium in a bottle at 11 o'clock, and every minute it doubles. By 12 o'clock, I've got so many billion bacteria, they fill the bottle. At what time was the bottle half full? Well, 1 minute before 12. When was it quarter full? 2 minutes before 12. So now, assume that these bacteria get worried when the bottle is quarter full or one-tenth full, or maybe some far-looking bacteria realize that there's going to be a problem at 11:53 when the bottle is 3% full. And so they say, we've got to go out and look for more bottles. And they look all around, and they look offshore, and deeper underground and all that. They find three more bottles. We've now quadrupled the amount of available space. This is a tremendous boon. We've really done our job now. Well, that's going to keep them going until 2 minutes after 12. But regardless of how much you conserve, all bets are off if you stay on an exponential growth rate. And the trouble is, as we said early on, is that regardless of what we do in this country, the growth of use of energy, fuel, other resources, water, minerals, so on, in the rest of the world is going to increase. It would be terribly imperialistic of us to assume or to demand that the rest of the world maintain its standard of living, even if we're willing to reduce ours and close the gap. And so sooner or later, we're going to get in trouble if we stay on any kind of an exponential growth, and that's what we're on now. See, you can reduce the utilization of energy or other resources, and what all you've really done is increase the doubling time. We're now on our energy use in the United States has doubled four times this century. So we're on a annual percentage increase of something like 4%, which is fairly modest. All right, supposing we reduce that to 3% or 2%. As long as it stays exponential, all we've done is found more bottles, and sooner or later we're going to fill them all up. Well, I wanted to get that lick in.
Your compliment.
Thank you all.